And actually, I think that's the key to health, ultimately. I think that we can withstand all kinds of assaults, and we can transmute all kinds of poisons and negative inputs as long as our internal state of being is clear, as long as we know what's true, as long as we're not lying to ourselves.
Greetings and love, beautiful humans. It's Ben Hardy, co-host of the show, explorer of all things terrain. Why is birth made out to be dangerous, scary, painful? Why are women shamed or made to feel guilty and irresponsible when they choose to give birth outside of the system? What if birth could be blissful, pain-free, orgasmic even? These are the questions being answered by this week's guest, Yolanda Norris Clark. Yolanda is a birth liberationist, a free birth pioneer, and she's also co-founder of the Radical Birthkeeper School with Emily Saldea, who came onto the show back in the fall. Mike and I knew after talking with Emily that we were not done with this conversation about birth, free birth, sovereign birth. We also realized why it is so important to be talking about it, especially in these, quote, health freedom circles. We were honored to have Yolanda on, especially as she is fresh off the heels of giving birth to her 10th child. We hope you find value in this conversation, and we humbly ask that if you do, you consider sharing it with someone who could benefit from it. All right, let's talk about birth. Welcome back to Terrain Theory. Okay, we are live. Yolanda Norris Clark, welcome to the Terrain Theory podcast.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here. I'm not alone, actually. There are two of us here. I'm here with my 9-week-old baby daughter, Margaret. And so if you hear some little snuffling sounds, that's her having a snack.
Beautiful.
Yolanda, tell us about yourself and how you got into this like free birth sovereignty space.
How did I get into the free birth sovereignty space? Well, honestly, there really isn't a time in my life that I can remember not being in the sovereignty space. I've been pretty strongly opinionated for my whole life. And actually, my own birth was a very traumatic hospital birth. And that was actually really the catalyst for the work I do today. I actually have, if not memories exactly, then certain kind of nightmare-esque impressions of my own entry into the world. But despite that unfortunate birth experience, my parents were both really amazing, intelligent, open-minded, and very anti-authoritarian people who encouraged me to question everything. And my mother especially was way ahead of her time when it came to her awareness of the body's innate intelligence and our capacity to heal spontaneously from anything, really. So I grew up completely outside of the, well, not completely, but for the most part, outside of the medical industrial complex. So my mom didn't take us to see pediatricians. We never had Tylenol. I've never had antibiotics in my life. So I was very lucky in that sense. And my mom always discussed her birth of me very openly, and always confirmed to me that she and I had both essentially been abused during her birth experience. And medical violation and the medical violations that she and I suffered were totally invasive and totally unnecessary. And she always knew and always professed to me that she would have been far better off giving birth alone, like a cat behind a bush in total privacy. I actually remember her saying those specific words on a couple of occasions. And at that time, you know, even as a young girl, that made total sense to me. And so I remember my mother saying to me as well many, many times throughout my childhood that although her birth experience with me had been traumatic and awful, that she could actually see that the world of obstetrics was changing and that by the time I grew up and decided to become a mother, I and her grandchildren, my children, would have a very different experience of birth than my mother did. Now, what my mom actually meant at that time, because she didn't have herself a full awareness of all of the dynamics at play, what she really meant was that she hoped that hospital birth and the sort of cultural birth practices would be reformed and that the system would be humanized and that women's rights in childbirth would be honored and that women would become empowered. And of course, none of that has come to pass, because what my mother didn't realize, and what a lot of people still don't necessarily realize, although this is changing, is that the medical industrial birth system and the medical system on the whole was never ever designed to do anything other than to inflict trauma and to create a population of people that are highly fractured and dissociated and psychologically dependent and really trauma bonded with the system. And actually, since my own birth in 1981, the obstetric system has changed. It certainly has changed in that it has become far more technocratic, far more insidiously coercive, far more abusive, far more anti-human and transhuman and cyborg than ever before. In fact, that's increasing. But what my mother got right, and she's totally aware of this now, was that I would never repeat the trauma that I endured as a newborn baby being born into this world, and that her grandchildren would never experience that same trauma. And in fact, in large part, thanks to my mother's willingness to be really honest with herself and honest with me and to decline the psychological programming, I have really made it my mission in life to lead, along with many other incredible women, including, of course, my best friend and co-conspirator, Emily Saldea, who you guys interviewed a little while ago. I'm really at the forefront with a lot of other women of what is clearly a worldwide revolution in birth that's occurring right now. And there's also a concurrent or parallel revolution happening in our understanding of self-healing and really in the reclamation of our sovereignty and power as human beings. And I feel so grateful to be alive right now and to have the immense privilege of witnessing women and men as well all around me just simply lifting the veil and knowing our birthright. So yeah, I've really always been in this work. But it really started full force with the birth of my first baby, because I initially I'd had sort of one toe in the system still. So when I became pregnant with my first child, I was 19 years old, and I knew I wanted a home birth, but I didn't really understand all of the political and social dynamics at play. And so first of all, hired a regulated midwife. So this is a midwife that works for the industrial medical system, essentially. And I saw immediately that this was not compatible with my personal values, which really are, I really do value sovereignty and self-responsibility. And I eventually relatively quickly fired that midwife, and I got in touch with a renegade underground midwife. Her name is Gloria LeMay, and incidentally, she's now being pretty heavily persecuted by the Canadian government still. She's had an ongoing kind of unfortunate relationship with the government of Canada. But anyway, I met her, and there was an immediate resonance, and she supported me in the births of my first two babies. And that was really one of the primary forms of initiation into this work. And I have been working with mothers and babies ever since, supporting sovereign birth in all its forms. Yeah.
So you were born in Canada, correct?
Yes, yes, I was born in Vancouver.
Yeah. Vancouver, and your first two children were also born up in Canada. You mentioned maybe some disagreements or lack of resonance with that first regulated midwife. Can you get into some more details about where you may have butted heads or just didn't see eye to eye?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't even so much that we didn't see eye to eye. It was that she didn't work for me. She worked for the government. And that's a conflict of interest. She wasn't able to actually support me in the choices that I was intent on making during my pregnancy and my birth. And that was evident. So there's a sort of built-in conflict of interest when you're receiving so-called health care or medical care or support or whatever or anything from someone who's not actually answerable to you. You know, when a health care provider, I mean, even that term is very interesting if you really think about it. Like I provide for myself. You know, I'm in the business of providing for myself. And there's a difference between being provided for and receiving support from someone, right? And I wasn't interested in being provided for. That was my job. That is my job. And it's my job as a mother for my children. But as an adult, you know, I provide for myself. So, yeah, it just was very clear to me that she had an agenda, and that agenda was dictated by the government of Canada. And the government of Canada does not have my best interests at heart, and they don't actually care what I want. So the whole idea that, you know, obstetrics can be reformed, and, you know, we need to be listening to mothers and mother-centered birth, all of that is nonsense. It's all a foil for what's really going on, which is control and authoritarianism.
You mentioned at the top that your mother made a prediction that didn't come true, a prediction that obstetrics would move in a better direction. And you said it's actually gone the other way and it's gotten worse. Can you dive into some of those details about some of the ways that it has taken a darker turn?
Yeah, well, I mean, in every way, industrial birth has become more technocratic. So there's more technology involved in pregnancy and birth now than ever before. And certainly when you look at the areas of IVF, you know, in vitro fertilization, I mean, there's just everything is the whole world has become more technology focused in many ways. But I'm not anti-technology. I think that can be used for good. I mean, here we are having this great conversation together, so that's amazing. But when it comes to birth, yeah, you know, even 20, 30 years ago, you know, we think of technologies like ultrasound surveillance, for example. And interestingly enough, obstetrics has actually always been at the forefront of the transhumanist project and at the forefront of surveillance technology. So a lot of these technologies that are being normalized now, you know, heavy duty surveillance, were began in military applications, but then were quickly adopted by the medical realm before really becoming mainstream. So ultrasound technology is now seen as really, it's almost unthinkable for most people to imagine going through a pregnancy without having your baby surveilled by this military technology, which is not benign, by the way. It has a very some very distinct effects.
Can you tell us a few of those effects? Because we didn't get into that with Emily, and I'd really like the audience to better understand what happens during an ultrasound.
Yeah, so ultrasound is a form of radiation. It's high frequency sound waves that are being projected onto and against and into the tissues and the bones of your baby. So I'm not a science person. I don't really care about science in the way that it's presented to most of us in the world today. But from what I understand, this is high frequency sound that is being kind of bounced off of our baby's bodies in utero. And I do I do find it interesting to note that, you know, everything is motion, right? Everything in the world, all matter is on some level arguably sound. So vibration is the basis of all life on Earth. And so these high frequency sounds, they have a physiological effect on mammalian cells and tissue. And fetal imaging is not the only application of ultrasound. Ultrasound is also used to break up tissues in other forms of medicine. So what I've been told is that ultrasound is also used in some cases to disintegrate tumors. So these high frequency sounds actually have the capacity to break down mammalian cells. And so in several animal studies, and this is an area that where things get kind of tricky, because there's an argument that I've come across frequently whereby the argument is that we're not animals, and so we can't make any kind of predictions as to how ultrasound will affect the body, the human body, when animal studies are done. But animals also have bones, and you know the basic structure of our bodies is similar. Like the flesh is similar, similar. And so in several animal studies, it's been shown that ultrasound can cause miscarriage or is correlated to high rates of miscarriage, that ultrasound can cause the cavitation of tissues. So it can actually break down important organs and tissue structures. There was a collection of studies that were done in China on babies that were aborted, and this showed some really, really disturbing evidence that ultrasound can cause really quite serious damage. Now, most people are not having, you know, exposing their babies to hours and hours and hours of ultrasound, and I also know that we can heal from all kinds of negative effects and exposures. And of course, we live in a world right now where there's radiation of all kinds that you know we have to navigate as human beings, and toxins and poisons and pesticides everywhere. So the another common argument is that we live in a toxic world, and the benefits of ultrasound are greater than the risks. And I don't see it that way, because one of the interesting studies that's also been done on ultrasound has shown that statistically the use of ultrasound doesn't improve outcomes. So however many ultrasounds you have, you still have the same chance of something going wrong, or your baby dying, or you dying, or what have you. So ultrasound doesn't have any kind of statistical effect on a positive outcome. I think there are much deeper concerns, however, when it comes to ultrasound. I think there are some profound spiritual ramifications to the use of ultrasound. I think what ultrasound is ultimately designed to do is to really break our connection as mothers with our intuition, and to create a kind of spiritual fracture. Because when you think about what ultrasound has done on a sort of social, cultural level, I want to go back to the fact that it's almost unheard of among certain circles that one would forego an ultrasound. And I think what this has created is a dynamic whereby when we see this in cell phone use and in all kinds of other areas of life, right? But this sort of externalization of our human reality. So for many women, the ultrasound isn't even about making sure that my baby's healthy, which is a fantasy anyway. Ultrasound cannot confirm to anyone whether or not a baby is healthy. Ultrasound doesn't even really show us all that much. It's like a fuzzy little black and white picture. And, you know, maybe that gray area is something, but you know, that's it. There's no magical way that doctors can interpret an ultrasound. They're seeing the same fuzzy black and white image that we are. But for many women, the ultrasound is the way that pregnancy becomes real. So it's not until we actually see the baby on the screen that a lot of women feel like they can embrace a kind of embodiment. So it's a form of normalizing disembodiment, I think. Among other things. So there's lots of reasons that I think ultrasound is an interesting technology that is also quite representative of a lot of the spiritual and psychological issues of our time.
You folks at the Free Birth Society really seem to exemplify the things that Ben and I talk about on this show every week. The main one I would say is agency, is really just the ability to work outside the system and do so unabashedly. It's like you said early on with your mother, like, well, by the time you're grown up, the system will have evolved, will have changed. And I think that's a through line I'm noticing throughout this burgeoning freedom community, is that agency is the word, is to take the bull by the horns and disregard the system and let it do what it's going to do and to live your life outside of it. And you guys really exemplify that more beautifully than any other space that I'm aware of. And it makes sense that the folks most interested in life at its inception would take this on and live it to its fullest potential. So I just want to sort of say thank you for having that intuition and then acting on it and starting this movement, because it's about as powerful as I've seen in this space so far.
Thank you. That's great to hear. And it's also, I'm only giggling because for me at this stage of my life, it's just normal. Like birth is just like, it's this, we're just human beings. So it's not a big deal.
But as you said just a moment ago, the idea of not getting an ultrasound done would be unheard of. Like all of these things that would be unheard of, that folks couldn't possibly fathom. And you're saying, well, hear of it. Here we go. Here we go. We're hearing of it. So thank you.
Yolanda, speaking of what is normal to you, in your arms, as you mentioned, is your 10th child, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
first of all, congratulations. But what I'd also love to know is a little more about the story of your child's birth. Like, what does birth look like and feel like to someone who is at the forefront of this like free birth movement?
Oh, that's a sweet question. And again, it's really just so normal, so easy, so fun. I have a good friend who years and years ago was involved in the birth movement with me in Canada. And she described the way that she feels about birth as sort of akin to composting. Like there was a time in the 70s when it was radical to compost your apple cores and your eggshells, you know, and people would talk about composting and they'd get together and they'd have like conferences about it. And it gets to a certain point where it's like, well, yeah, I mean, it's just how the world works. You know, you compost your fruit. So birth I like to describe birth as, on one hand, it is the most sacred, most holy, most incredible experience that any of us can have, being born and giving birth. And it's also the most normal everyday thing and not a big deal at all. And every birth is exactly the same. And every birth is totally unique and totally precious and is the most beautiful story. So yeah, I've got little Margaret in my arms right now, and she's 9 weeks old, or just about 9 weeks old, just over 2 months old. And she, like all my babies, she's just the most incredible gift to our family. We all, oh my goodness, here we go. Yeah, happy baby, sweet pie. We all just adore her. All her big brothers and sisters love her so much. And I expected her to arrive. And, you know, my pregnancy with her, like all of my pregnancies, or certainly my most recent pregnancies, are, it's just an extension of my normal life. So I don't do anything special or interesting during pregnancy. I, you know, like sex makes babies. So, you know, I do that with my husband and then I find out I'm pregnant because my body changes and, you know, I know my cycle and I'm aware of my existence. And then I just eat and sleep and lie in the sun and play with my kids and work and live my life. And over time, my baby grows in my womb and then eventually they get born. And that's really how it goes. There's nothing more interesting than that about it. And that really is how I experience pregnancy and birth. And I think that too is quite shocking for a lot of people. Like, wait. You mean you don't measure anything and you don't like pee in a little cup and you don't da da da. And also, oh my goodness, you're in your 40s. Like, what about, And there's none of that exists for me now. It doesn't even cross my mind to do any of that rigmarole. So it's just part of my normal life. But I did have some expectations about Margaret's birth, which is funny because babies have their own timeline. I expected her to arrive sometime in mid-December. If anything, I know by now that babies do really come on their own time, especially after having my first 8 babies at around 44 weeks gestation. And then my 9th baby came at 39 weeks, which is quite a bit shorter pregnancy. So, I don't actually want to know when my babies are coming. The surprise is just so delightful and so fun. But every day, probably during the last 2 months of my pregnancy with Margaret, I was experiencing at some point during the day sensations that were strong enough that I thought, this is it. Today's the day. It's happening. And so I would announce to my husband that like the baby's coming and everyone would get all worked up and excited. And then there would be no baby and I would go back to sleep. And so I think as often happens, I just had to come to terms with the apparent fact that, you know, maybe I wasn't even really pregnant at all. And I just had some bizarre abdominal growth and I just gave up, you know, like, forget it. Fine. I won't even think about this anymore. I'll just get on with my life. And so I went to bed the night before Christmas Eve. And at this point I was about 43 weeks pregnant, which incidentally is a longer period of time than what most women are allowed to have for their gestation. So we have a really important culture in this day and age around bypassing the timeline of pregnancy and inducing babies. So one of the most predominant narratives in industrial birth is that pregnancy has to adhere to a certain timeline. And most women, after they pass 40 weeks of gestation, according to the way that pregnancy is calculated, which is also kind of bizarre and twisted, but I won't get into that. Most women are told that, you know, if your pregnancy proceeds past 41 weeks, then you're in grave danger and your baby is in grave danger and something needs to be done. And, you know, we need to like extract the baby from your body forcibly. And I don't have anything to do with that because it's complete nonsense. And it's all part of the program really to sabotage birth. So that's not part of my reality either. And so I'm lying in bed at 43 weeks pregnant. And I went to sleep that night. And I woke up at around 2 a.m., as I often do during pregnancy. And I was lying there just for a few minutes and feeling my baby move around. And then all of a sudden, she kicked. And I felt a kind of tearing sensation in my womb. And there was an immediate deluge of water. The amniotic fluid just flooded our bed. And my husband was in the washroom at the time, and I screamed, not in pain at all, but I was just completely surprised and shocked. I immediately knew that this was the impending arrival of our baby. And sure enough, the sensations began right away. And every wave was just pure ecstasy and orgasmic bliss. And at exactly 3 a.m., so 1 hour after my water's released, Margaret was born on our bed, and she was covered in vernix, which is the waxy coating that protects babies in the womb, protects their skin. She was also covered in meconium. She had her umbilical cord wrapped around her neck, which is, of course, totally perfect and normal and to be expected even. And we loved her immediately, and that was that. We just snuggled her and met her and talked to her, and our older kids woke up and ran into the room, and you know, they're always welcome to be around me when I'm giving birth, but it just so happened that everyone was asleep and Margaret came quickly. So yeah, everyone came in, met her, and we snuggled and then went back to sleep. That's how it happened.
It's amazing to think that. And that's another unheard of thing I would categorize, is that the family was sleeping while mom gave birth. Just snug as pugs in a rug. Just
They were all asleep. And actually, I was very, very quiet during Margaret's birth as well. I vocalized a little bit, but especially when she was emerging, I was very quiet because I was just experiencing the psychedelic amazingness of it all. And I tend to be very quiet when I give birth now, but I've had a really wide variety of birth experiences. And it was only during my previous birth, the birth of the baby previous to Margaret, whose name is Helio. Helio is 2 years old. So there's almost exactly 2 years between Margaret and Helio. And Helio's birth was my first birth experience where I learned how birth can be completely blissful and ecstatic. I learned how to experience birth that way. And actually what I learned was that birth is designed to be ecstatic and euphoric and completely pain-free. And I didn't understand that before because I had absorbed the imprints and the programming of our very distorted culture. And I think that birth is often painful and intense for women, not only because they are simultaneously being tortured and abused, but also because the belief system that birth is supposed to be agonizing and painful is so powerful that we make that true through this kind of subconscious programming. And once we can divest ourselves of that, which is what I talk about in my program portal and in the book portal that I wrote, and there are many ways of going about that, it's actually very, very, very easy to experience a blissful birth. And that's actually how we're created as human beings, is my conviction.
It's pretty wild that even someone such as yourself, it took until birth 9 to sort of break free from that programming. It's especially given the work that you do and the lifetime you've had in this space.
That's funny. Yeah, like what took me so long? Why am I such a late bloomer? That's a good question.
Well, but on the other hand, I think a lot of us, especially, you know, Ben and I sort of launched ourselves into the terrain theory world just a couple of years ago. So it's been a lot of trial by fire. And there's a lot of, I think we put this expectation on ourselves to like figure it out soon. Like, well, I've got the knowledge, implement, but it doesn't work that way. Like, things take time for all of us.
I think that's true sometimes. And I also have seen lots of evidence. I mean, I think it can work both ways. You know, sometimes
sure.
Things take time, and it's a process for all of us. But I've also seen and experienced myself that sometimes these transformations can really be quite immediate and can be quite transformational. So in a way, I think that's what happened. I think it also can be both. So I think maybe it was both for me. I've had so much experience in birth, and I've witnessed so many women giving birth, and I've had so many babies myself. But when it came time for me to be invited into the possibility of experiencing birth differently, the change was actually quite swift in a sense. And the other thing too, and I think this is true when it comes to our relationship with dis-ease, because I also work a lot in the self-healing space. Well, I'll speak for myself. I loved the agony and the pain and the drama and the like just delicious suffering of all of my first 8 births. I was really into it. I cultivated it and ultimately I chose it. And that's really, I think, what all of this is about. What, you know, if we distill what we're sort of circling around to its essence, we choose suffering and pain and disease in most ways. And when I was willing to grow up and to actually get really intimate with what I wanted and what was available to me, that's when the revelation occurred that, like, it doesn't have to be this way. And the other piece too, which I think is fascinating, and this is where I sort of go, wow, it really did take me a long time to figure this one out. Sex makes babies, and sex is pretty great. And all of the same hormones and all of the same organs and all of the same body parts that we are involved in sex are also how babies are born. And so what's really amazing to me is that the inverted programming has been so powerful that we now live in a world where not only do most people believe that birth is supposed to be painful and that that's normal and that that's to be expected, but most people also believe that in order to heal or to process through a healing cycle or for uncomfortable symptoms to subside, we need magic potions and special pills and the influence and attention of experts and authorities. I mean, that's mind-blowing too to me at this stage in my life. Like, of course birth is normal, and of course our bodies are designed to heal. The body is always oriented towards healing. And the real task for most of us is to just get out of our own way. And that's the same when it comes to birth.
There are so many, parallels between healing the medical industrial complex and this birthing industrial complex. And you hit on what I think is maybe the most profound observation or truth, and that is about your belief system. And I find myself, because I have a seven-year-old, and reading children's books to him, I'm hyper aware as co-host of this Terrain Theory podcast, and as Mike and I are 2 years into this health odyssey, like reclaiming our own sovereignty and agency, I'm hyper aware of the messaging in the books that he's reading. And some of these are classic books that I grew up reading, messaging around things like the body and wellness, what makes you sick, going to the doctor, what the doctor's going to then give you. And it dawns on me after the conversation with Emily, but really now after this conversation with you, how we are programmed to believe through story, through books, really through media, television shows, and movies, what that birth experience is supposed to look like. And pain and fear are really the overarching messages that you see. It's very rare. I don't think I've ever seen a birth play out on screen that didn't involve screaming and pain and swearing, and also the hospital and doctors. And they take what is, as you've articulated, what is a perfectly normal and natural biological event that can be orgasmic and blissful, and it's been turned into a medical emergency, and one that where lives are at stake. There's no way that you can cut it. And this is a function of both programming, and that programming begets a belief system. And so Mike might joke about why did it take you, to get to your eighth child, but we are subjected to a lifetime of programming around what you know, what it might be, what it's supposed to be. And so I think that as I think about how I'm going to reflect on this conversation, I think the most powerful message is one of the belief system. And I think that's one of the most powerful things that you are doing in this space, is to provide an alternative story, and one that comes from a place of intuition. And we have to believe that this is really the intuition that's in every single woman, that this is what's there. And it's, you've just not been able to listen to it because of the programming that we've all been subjected to around what is the most important part of human existence, is giving life, bringing new life into the world. So kudos to you for telling a different story.
Thank you. And I'm really glad you said that, because there is nothing special about me at all. And that is being proven true in the thousands and thousands of women who are reclaiming their own power. I mean, I'm not alone by any stretch. This is totally available to every single woman.
Yolanda, let's hear a little bit about the Radical Birthkeeper School. Tell us what that is. Tell the audience what that is.
Sure. Well, the Radical Birthkeeper School is the alternative institution that my best friend and colleague Emily Saldea and I have started. It is the only online midwifery school that teaches birth and birth work through the lens of the sovereign birth paradigm. And what that means is that we are the only program that really fully recognizes that the mother is the sole authority over her birth experience, and that the mother is the only expert in her body and her baby and her birth experience. And that birth is wholly owned, fully and completely, by the mother herself. And that the midwife's role, the role of what we think of as an authentic midwife, is to support the mother's experience entirely. And I think what's very important, and something that we really focus on in the school, is that not all women want to give birth alone. Not all women want to give birth only with their partners. And that for a lot of women, especially actually women who eventually do choose free birth, which is, you know, birth that occurs outside of any kind of formal relationship with any kind of birth keeper. For a lot of women who choose free birth, eventually they make that choice in the context of having been supported at one point during a previous birth by someone who really fully honors her agency and her sovereignty. And this is lacking in the world of midwifery, because in the past 50 years, governments all over the world have effectively appropriated the term midwife. And that term now has come to mean someone who has been trained in medical academia to sabotage birth, just like an obstetrician, to put it bluntly. And there's lots of variation, and there are lots of wonderful women who are in midwifery, and there's lots of people who disagree with me, and that's fine. But what I've seen overwhelmingly in my work, especially in the work that I do in birth trauma, so I have coached hundreds, if not thousands, of women at this point who've come to me to unpack their traumatic birth experiences. And maybe even the majority of those women have experienced trauma by the hands of well-intentioned but highly programmed and indoctrinated midwives who believe that what they're doing is holistic birth and natural birth, but who actually are carrying water for the medical industrial complex. So the Radical Birthkeeper School is a school, an education program for women who are interested in supporting birth in a way that truly honors women's sovereignty. And what we teach is among other things, this is a really core component of our of the philosophy of what we teach, is the distinction between being an authority in birth and being an expert in birth, which is very important for a midwife, versus assuming authority over a woman's birth or over her body, or positioning oneself as having any expertise over the experience of a birthing woman. So those are very, very different things. And that's, we focus on making sure that our students understand the politics of power, really. And we're also the only midwifery school, I would argue, that approaches birth physiology from a truly holistic perspective, with an acknowledgement that the spiritual and energetic aspects of the unfolding of birth are inseparable, really, from the physiology of birth. So it's really quite an amazing, unique program, and we're seeing our many, many graduates. There are, many hundreds of women have already done our program, and they are working all over the world in service to birth liberation, supporting women in a multitude of ways, including in person, in women's birth spaces, but also through coaching and childbirth education, and many other areas too. So, yeah.
And so if I'm a woman and I'm thinking about starting a family, or perhaps I'm pregnant and thinking about what that birth is going to look like, how would I find someone who has been trained in your school? Is it as simple as going onto your site and doing a search geographically?
Well, it's not quite as simple as that yet. However, at the moment, Emily, through the Free Birth Society, her amazing platform. She has a database of women who are radical birth keepers. And right now that database is accessible through Emily's private network, because we're still at a very interesting crossroads right now. So the empire is dying, as I'm sure you see in lots of areas. And the institutions that have historically held power over human beings, like the medical industrial complex, like obstetrics, which of course is part of that overarching institution. Political structures are breaking down before our eyes. It's all crumbling. So it's a very exciting time to be alive. But in the last sort of death throes of this empire of control, we're seeing also lots of efforts on the part of the controllers to reassert their dominance. And so we do still have to be, skillful in the way that we share our information, in the way that we speak about birth, and in the way that we, sort of disseminate this information. And it's spreading like wildfire. So there are independent birth keepers in every community, and so a great way to find one is to join Emily's private network for any women out there who are looking for a radical birth keeper. But we're not the only. We don't have any kind of ownership over this. This is a very organic grassroots movement, and even reaching out to a friend. A lot of women choose a birth keeper amongst their close friends. There are women in every community who may not know anything about birth, but who are open to supporting a sister in birth. Mm-hmm. And so that's another wonderful way of making this work real.
Mm-hmm. Very grassroots, very organic, as you said. Yolanda, you also recently published a book. Can you tell us a little bit about that book and what the listener could expect to learn from reading it?
Yes, I did recently write and publish my first book. It's called Portal, The Art of Choosing Orgasmic, Pain-Free, Blissful Birth. And what can the reader learn? What might someone learn from reading it? Broadly, a reader will learn how to choose orgasmic, pain-free, blissful birth. but as many people have observed who have read the book, It's not really a book about birth, actually, or rather, it's not just about birth. And actually, I've received some really wonderful feedback from several people who've read the book who've said that they think everyone should read it, including men. So it's a book that is really about the fact that, as I said before, every form of suffering is on a certain level a choice. You're not necessarily a conscious choice, but a choice that is created from the aggregate moves that we make on the chessboard of life, right? And every form of victimhood and victimization, we actually contract into on some level. And what the book also discusses, and this is incredibly important, I think, and this is also an answer to anyone who's listening and who's immediately thinking that this sounds like victim blaming, is that consenting to our victimization, which we do, you know, we consent to our hardship and our suffering, on some level, as I said, we contract into victimization. This does not mean that we are to blame for anything. In fact, as I see it, self-blame is really the antithesis of self-responsibility. So the book is about self-responsibility. It's about how to be a fully actualized, fully individuated, sovereign human being, which, let me be the first to admit, I'm really very much only at the beginning stages of exploring for myself. And, you know, I found that the more that we're willing to look at just how much we enjoy victimhood and whining and suffering and feeling sorry for ourselves, the more we see just how ginormous the iceberg of that particular dynamic is for individuals, but also on a societal level. So, yeah, it's a book about birth, but also life and how to thrive. Yeah. Beautiful. Life doesn't have to be a struggle, you know. Abundance and pleasure and ease in birth and in life really is our birthright.
Hear, hear. Yolanda, you also have some compelling healing stories and experiences that seem to sort of intertwine and inform your work in free birthing. And I'm wondering if you could share some of those healing experiences. And you mentioned that you were brought up to believe in this sort of innate healing power of the body. I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah, I was. And, you know, I've had experiences kind of on both sides of this issue. I've experienced some really significant traumas related to the medical field, so my own birth. But I also had major abdominal surgery when I was 14 years old, 13 or 14 years old. I had my gallbladder removed. And at the time, you know, my mom really was very, very countercultural, and I adore my mom, and the vast majority of the decisions that she made on my behalf as a child, I am so grateful for. But in this case, she was really coerced by, again, well-intentioned doctors into agreeing that I should have this surgery because it was presented to her as, you know, the only option, and this is life or death, and, you know, all of the things that we're told. And that was a very traumatic experience for me. And I saw at that time, even as a young girl, that this was not necessary and that I actually hadn't been saved by the doctors at all. I'd been maimed. And I'd had one of my organs stolen, one of my essential organs. Of course, you know, all of our organs are essential. And so that was another, you know, we all have these sort of layers of experiences, you know, stages of experiences that all are part of our initiation. And that was an important experience for me. And so since then, really, I have not had anything to do with doctors or hospitals. And I've gone through some pretty intense healing cycles that I have dealt with independently, including a pretty major episode of kidney infection and kidney stones. And for the past several years, I have been studying the work of Rika Geert Hommer, who was a German physician who developed what is generally known as German New Medicine, or the sacred medicine. And I use a lot of Hommer's ideas and theories in what I'm my own protocol that I've developed in my own approach to self-healing. So in addition to birth and birth work, my other passion and purpose in the world is to share and teach about the power that we have as human beings to heal spontaneously. And that in fact, every symptom is a very powerful message from the body that is pointing us towards some area of our consciousness that is dissonant. Every symptom is essentially indicative of some kind of internal double bind, some area of our lives that we are in denial of or delusional about or afraid to fully own. And the thing is that birth and self-healing are kind of one and the same. You know, many of our areas of healing, many of our symptoms arise as a result of the programming and the imprints that we have that are established during our entry into the world. So it's birth itself that really lays the foundation in many ways of what I describe as a person's energetic quaternity. So the confluence of body, mind, psyche, and spirit, and really birth and the way that we're welcomed into the world has such a profound effect on how we mother our babies, and also our relationship to our mothers. And you know, infancy and childhood and early childhood, and our relationship to the mother is the substrate of how we see the world and how we understand our place in the world and our relationship to our power and agency in the world. So yeah, birth and self-healing are really, yeah, inseparable, one and the same in many ways.
If I were to sum this conversation up in one sentence, it would be that you're bringing spirit back to birthing, to birth, which is a simple thing to say, but a profound thing to manifest. But before we let you go, and I know you've got your beautiful Margaret on your lap there, and I want to keep you all day, although we easily could you just speak a little bit more about your mother? Because you've mentioned her several times, and she sounds like a pretty extraordinary woman. And I'd just like to know a little bit more about her.
Ah, she is an extraordinary person. You're going to make me cry because she just visited us here in Nicaragua where we live. And it was a very, very short 2-week visit. My mother is an extraordinary woman. She is courageous and hilarious and open-minded. And she is also really very normal. And yeah, you know, I think she would be so embarrassed and uncomfortable with right. this part. I'm going to have to warn her about this podcast. She would just say, "What are you talking about? This is ridiculous." She's very humble, but also very wise. And I love my mom. She, she's everything. She made me who I am in all ways. And I think it's very much a testament to my mother that my own children very confidently describe me as, you know, like a pretty mediocre mom. Like, I'm okay. So yeah, we're all just a bunch of pretty mediocre normal moms doing our thing.
And that's the goal, right?
I think that's the goal. Yeah, what could be better?
Yeah, a C. Barely... It's a passing grade.
C+, come on.
C+.
Oh dear.
Yolanda, a question we ask all of our guests as we come to the end here. What are your non-negotiables, the daily habits that you do to tend to your terrain?
Oh my goodness. Well, you know, I've been asked this kind of question before, and you know, in the past I've talked about food, and you know, I like to go to the gym, and I always take a walk. I like to walk every day. I would like to say that the sun, getting sun every day. But when I really think about it, everything is negotiable. Mm. Like everything is negotiable in life. And I really enjoy my daily rhythm, and I have my, you know, my things that I do that make me feel good. I like to be healthy and to feel healthy, but actually everything is negotiable, and you know, I have my moments like everyone else. But what I can say absolutely is non-negotiable for me, and has always been non-negotiable for better or worse, is saying what I really think, saying what I know to be true. That probably is my only non-negotiable, and it's got me into a lot of trouble in the past, but it's also been really the key to my success and my thriving. And actually, I think that's the key to health. Ultimately, I think that we can withstand all kinds of assaults, and we can transmute all kinds of poisons and negative inputs, as long as our internal state of being is clear, as long as we know what's true, as long as we're not lying to ourselves. So, yeah, speaking the truth is my non-negotiable.
That, I think in over 100 episodes, that might be the best one I've heard yet. Not that I'm judging, not that it's a competition, but that's really profound and beautiful and so simple and for many of us very difficult. So thanks for laying that out there.
Yolanda, where can the listener learn more about you and your work?
Yes. Well, my website is YolandaNorris-Clark, Yolanda with an E, .com. And I'm all over Instagram at Bauhauswife. And you can subscribe to my little online magazine via Substack. So those are probably the best ways to stay in touch with me.
And we'll put those links in the show notes. Yolanda Norris-Clark, thank you so much for joining us on the Terrain Theory Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
After party, pineal room, go.
Oh my God. I'm a little speechless, honestly. I don't know what to say. I'm sort of basking in the afterglow, in the after party of that beautiful, wonderful, heart-centered guest we just had the pleasure of hanging out with.
She didn't know this at the time when she answered the question, but both she and Emily Saldea, her co-conspirator, answered that non-negotiable question almost identically. Nothing is non-negotiable, which I guess you'd expect from someone who is so into sovereignty, right? Like radical freedom is to not even hold yourself to anything.
Yeah, that's well said.
As a non-negotiable.
Yeah, well, also someone who has 10 children as well, you probably have to roll with the punches at some point, just at a practical level, functional art level. I think Jude Roberts also has answered the question that way too. So
yes,
you're in good company, Jude.
Yeah. Yeah. She just reframed a lot. And it was like Emily was a wrecking ball for me.
Right.
In the best of ways. I think there are a lot of folks who may have been prickled a little bit by Emily, because she's very direct in how she speaks about her experiences and what's going on.
There was some pushback on the socials, I believe, that you shared. Yeah.
Yep. Some pushback on the socials. But I value that. I mean, as you know, that was a very emotional episode for me, because like she was a wrecking ball to this Grayson's birth story.
Yeah.
And Yolanda, it's funny because it feels like Yolanda then built something up in its place. Hmm. About stripping, rebuilding an image, an idea, a belief system around birth that does not have fear. There's no place for fear or alarm or any authority but your own. And I think that's, to me, as those two as a 1-2 punch, I mean, you can see why they would be so powerful. They're so perfect as co-conspirators, as collaborators. But for me specifically, this concept, this topic around birth and free birth and sovereignty, a remarkable 1-2 punch. One was the wrecking ball, and the other one is the Bauhaus, the artist, the architect coming in and saying, let's just rebuild your idea, your concept of what birth is and can be.
Yeah, and I really respect the fact that she really embodies moving beyond the doom and gloom and the Agenda 2030 and all like the fear porn. She'll acknowledge it. And she said so herself, like where they chose to move and some of the life decisions they've made are a product of that education and research and awareness, but she's beyond it now. Now she's just building the new world and making the old world obsolete. And I, more than anyone else, I feel like we've spoken to, and in this birth space, I felt like I was sort of fumbling, trying to actually get at what was striking me as so profound, but there's really no better place than to see where the rubber meets the road in terms of like standing up as a sovereign than in inception, where life starts. And it's just so goddamn beautiful. And we talk about the prismatic health all the time, and they're again embodying spirit centered procedures, for lack of a better term. That's the utmost importance. Everything else falls in the wake of leading with spirit and like bringing animism back, as opposed to like the atomic materialistic worldview that's sort of like held us in its clutches for centuries or millennia. I feel like they are the embodiment of for the first time, maybe since we've done this project, it's like, this is real. This movement is real. And there's lots of people doing wonderful work around it. But for some reason, in the birth space is where it seems to like have the most profound resonance in ripples that I see moving forward.
It's ground zero for every individual. It is ground zero for your health. And think of the opposite, Michael. Think of the stories of the opposite. Well, what unfortunately is the norm? Like if you are, I have to be very careful about how we talk about this.
I know.
Yolanda does a good job too of just saying, look, it's not victim blaming, but this is just speaking reality. So I'm going to speak this truth as I feel it, the same way that she suggested that we do. But what is normal that you're whisked off to the hospital in panic as an emergency, like what you think is like an emergency medical event? I've got to get to the hospital or else. Once you're in there, she has a beautiful Substack article called The Obstetric Hegelian Dialectic, which we're familiar with that phrase in sort of the space around Agenda 2030 and the Great Reset and thing, but create the problem and then you have the solution. And this is what happens in obstetrics. Their invasiveness creates problems and then they also have the solution. And this all leads to a traumatic birth for the mother, a traumatic birth for the baby. So your first instances taking breath in this life are surrounded in trauma in a room where you're not treated like a sovereign spiritual being. That's not the way that you're, and again, this is a generalization. Others might have different stories, but, and then what happens to that child? Typically, Like, what is then injected into that child again and again, right at birth? So the very foundation, the very first breaths, those, that first day, those first second that you're here, it's trauma, it's fear, it's poison, and that's it. And then it's, you know, this is your first step into the world. What they're doing is the complete opposite, and it is getting back to nature. We, from day one, man, with our roots in Daniel Quinn and Ishmael, is all been about getting back to nature, living more closely to nature, mimicking what happens in nature. And what they're doing is not pioneering, it's reclaiming. It's just a return.
Yeah, she said that several times. It's normal. This is normal.
This is normal. And we've just been so abnormal. All of humanity has just been, most of it anyway, 99% of it. So I just have infinite respect for what she and Emily and all the others who are in this free birth space are doing, because I don't think there's anything more important than starting at day one, you know, ground zero for a new life.
Yeah, and to hear her say that it's catching on like wildfire, I think that's what fired me up. It's like, oh, that is so good to hear.
This is it. This is the new system that's rendering the old one obsolete.
Correct.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, what you're saying about witnessing someone building it, her and Emily, and we're starting to see others, too, who we're seeing the evolution. We're witnessing the evolution, not necessarily in a person as it's happening, but we're seeing the stages, aren't we? We're having more interaction with people who are in that next stage, who are building the thing, who are living in the new system that's rendering the old one obsolete. And they have no time or energy for the old system, and they're not feeding it anymore. They're simply not giving it any of its any energy or any attention. And their lives reflect it. You can see it in the way that she presents, the way that she speaks, the way that she holds her child, her retelling the story of giving birth to Margaret. It's all right there. And it's really, really fun to see. And it's interesting, Mike, because we're still, you know, I still have a foot in obviously still have a foot in this system. And in interacting with the world in that system, like the digital world I'm thinking of specifically, where people present themselves, and still so much of it, even people that we've interacted to in this like freedom space, truth or space, whatever you want to call it, are still feeding that system, aren't they? Like energetically, they're still tied to that system. And you see it in the messaging, you see it in the words that they use when they speak, the words that they use when they write. And I'm doing it too. I'm still there. I'm not extracted fully, but talking to someone like Yolanda and Emily is so inspiring.
Yeah. And that's the word I would use too.
It just, makes me want to be like, okay, cut that cord. Just cut that cord to the old system. Yep. No more hooks in me, no more energy siphon, no more attention siphon.
Yep. Hear, hear. Yes. A really inspiring woman. And, sort of set me up for the rest of my day for sure.
Hang on, let me just type the flights to Nicaragua. Land in Nicaragua. Let me do search. It has popped up. As I told her after we stopped recording, Nicaragua has popped up on my radar now a couple times, a few more times recently than ever before. And so you know how we are. No coincidences.
No coincidences.
It does have me looking.
You remember early on 2020 when things were getting weird and you and I were exploring, where do we go?
Costa Rica.
We were looking at Costa Rica.
Yes, we were.
Yeah.
Yes, we were. Maybe it's Nicaragua. I will tell you this, and I'm telling you and I'm telling everyone else who's in the after party in the Pineal Room. If we have another reoccurrence of what happened in 2020, if we have anything close to that, I'm gone. I don't think I'm going to stick around in the States. Yeah. I think it'll be time to pull up stakes and go somewhere like Nicaragua or Costa Rica.
Yeah.
Cause I don't think I have any interest in being here as it all falls down. like basically staying in the building as it's on fire or collapsing around me. I'm not certain that I want to do that, or I want Grayson to go through that.
That's a bold statement, but I think you're right. I think you're right.
Yeah. So Nicaragua or bust.
Mm-hmm.
Get the surfboards ready, baby.
Mm-hmm.
Get the surfboards ready. All right, yeah. Folks. Well, Nicaragua. I can't wait to get some emails from folks who have an opinion about Nicaragua. By the way, speaking of opinions, I've been fielding some interesting responses to the Julia Lupin episode. And by now it's out there. Obviously people have had a chance to hear it. And it's a head scratcher for me, and I'm trying to meditate my way through my reaction to other folks' reaction. And I think some of it is just not 100% buying her story, which is what's something that she's experienced her whole life. Like, this is all in your head, get over it kind of thing. Which
Isn't
is so
just
fascinating.
Like ultimate gaslighting.
For her. Yes. That would, if I were in her shoes, that's how I'm sure I would feel. Even not in her shoes as the person who chatted with her, I kind of feel that. I think it's maybe the empathy in me. And to, I guess, to folks out there, I would go get her book. Because she just gets, there's way more nuance in her book, way more detail in her book. And I also found it really entertaining. Cool. Like, she's a good writer, and you really go on a journey. And it's not a boring one. Like, she bops back and forth between past and present. And I found it fascinating and compelling. And I also found it real and truthful.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think this is what folks who have electrosensitivity face. I think that they face this in the real world. People going, I'm not feeling what you're feeling. And this all just sounds like it's in your head.
Yeah. Well, you know, just yesterday, while we're on the subject, I've had on my list for a while to get in touch with my internet provider and figure out how to disable the wireless signal from my modem.
Yeah.
And so I finally remembered how to freaking log in and change the password, like you have to do with things you don't have to log into too often. And I'm chatting with a representative, and she just couldn't get it through her head why anyone would want to do this. So she kept answering the question, but not the question I was asking. She's telling me how to turn wireless off on the device, but she just didn't understand why anyone would want it off on the modem. And it finally, we got to the place where it's not possible to do with this company. So I'd probably have to switch internet service providers to find a modem where you can, because, you know, Roski talks about this all the time. Oh, it's easy. Just turn off the wireless and hardwire everything. And I'm very, very down to do that. I feel like, I think a lot of the body stuff that I have going on right now is repetitive stress induced. But I have to include in the repetitive stress is letting this phone dangle from my left hand for like most of the day for however many years. And I think that's part of why my shoulder just won't quit. So I want a more hardwired existence, but it's not possible through Spectrum. So there's that. But it's also been, I've been realizing, you know, as we try to itemize the different, just to have the awareness of the different toxins that the family might be up against. And I've noticed my family's been very ill this winter. I'm just trying to do what I can where I can. So it is top of mind, partly maybe because of that conversation that actually got me to take action. But like I said, with my shoulder and the phone and the kids being sick and the ubiquitous screens and internet, I would like it to be a little bit more under my control. And that's what I'm attempting to do. So I took the first step into that world.
Yeah, it's funny that so what you're telling me is the Matrix won't allow you to exit the Matrix. That's a big surprise.
Not via that corporation.
So yeah. Are you in your house, are you already set up to be hardwired?
Yeah.
You are.
In fact, but it like my laptop, I have a 12-year-old MacBook. I can't believe it's still going, but it has like the built-in, I know you can get the adapters for the new computers as well, but it has a built-in Ethernet port in the computer and I use it anytime I use my laptop.
So if you're in the house though, you have like an Ethernet jack like in each room and you can just plug right in. Okay.
Ruth's dad, we live in the house Ruth grew up in and her dad had that set up, you know, a long time ago. So like right now I'm hardwired up in the studio. The kitchen has a hardwire port. The front room has a hardwire port.
Yep.
We have sort of an awkward cable coming from under the staircase up to our bedroom. So hardwiring is happening. It's just not ubiquitous with every device. And it seems like I should be able to turn the wireless off if I'm going to be hardwired anyway. It's like the wireless is still on, you know?
Can you do, just get a big Faraday bag or something? Throw it over. Like, couldn't you potentially do something like that?
Oh, you're not joking. Yeah, I suppose I could. I've got
a big like leather helmet for your router.
Let's try. I'll try. I've got an orgone pyramid in there, but I don't know. You know.
Yeah. Right. We'll find out more about orgone soon, won't we?
Yeah, that's coming up too. But you know, we do what we can. We do what we can.
Do what you can. So the
Sorry to interrupt you, but I think folks know my bed, my mattress is grounded with copper wire wrapped around, thinner wire around the mattress, and then a thicker wire that goes out the window and down into a copper spike in the ground. But she mentioned essentially a grounding rod that's just a wire that's wrapped around a spoon. And I've added that to my bed situation. So there's like an extra little spoon wire that comes off of the main copper wiring on the bed that I like sort of just hold on to as I'm falling asleep and eventually it falls out of my hand. But yeah.
So I want, when are you going to build the copper pyramid canopy over your bed?
I want to build one in the kitchen to keep produce under and fruit under, because that was something I believe Devon mentioned.
Yes.
Right. Or maybe it was Matt Roski. Yeah, I've had a couple pyramid projects on my list that maybe I'll get to this spring.
Yeah.
But under the bed. Wow. I didn't think for the bed. That's a great idea.
It's a big, like a canopy.
Yeah.
And then how the folks, I don't know that we mentioned this on the last after party, because I don't think this had happened yet, but Mike and I are officially TMing, right?
We took a transcendental TM workshop.
Meditation. Yes.
Yeah. How's that going for you?
It's almost been like a light switch for me.
Amazing.
In my life.
Okay.
And maybe this is all in my head. Anyone out there listening can certainly point at me and just be, it's all in your head too. However, from that first session, that first 20-minute session, just things like kind of clicked. My days clicked. Energies clicked. Synchronicities were happening. The day was like unfolding sort of effortlessly in front of me the same way that a TM session is supposed to happen, and it's continued. I've kept up like two a day, and it's done wonders for my mindset going into previously what would have been like even like mildly stressful situations, or like a deadline looming, or like a big meeting looming, or some presentation or something. I just am not feeling the stress. And I'm feeling like all in all, my stress dial has just gone down since starting. And this has just been we started last week, right?
Yeah. That's fantastic. I think it was last Wednesday. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great, Ben.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
How about you?
Yeah, I think I'm feeling those residual effects like you just mentioned. One, I am struggling a little bit during the 20-minute meditations because it's different than what I have been doing for the last couple of years, where I had a pretty good routine that I enjoyed, which was more of a breathwork routine. It was sort of marrying some LSDD breathing with some mindfulness for 15 or 20 minutes. And that was really working for me. And I just, you know, you don't have time to do all of these things every day. No. And so it's an adjustment. But because I'm so grateful that Chris took the time to give us that experience in that workshop, I'm committed to it for a while just to give it a chance, you know, before I maybe revert or mix up some of my other protocols. But one thing I'm having trouble finding time is I think I mentioned a terahertz wand for Christmas, and I've been you know, I think when we interviewed Amanda, one of her main complaints that she was trying to address was her frozen shoulder. Mm-hmm. Since I've got this shoulder that won't quit since November, it's been a few months now. You know, it's not debilitating, but it's not like my it's not like my right shoulder, which is like fluid and pain free. You know, it's really, it's just sort of irks me. But it's a real big time commitment to have to go through the recommended procedure for implementing a session with that. Yeah. So I think that's my biggest con about that device. Is just, I just don't necessarily have like 90 minutes every day to sit and like
to do a session. Time.
Yeah. You know, there's like a half hour of sort of warming up your body and doing these different sort of acupuncture points. And that's if you're like staring at the clock and not spacing out. I've sort of figured, and you sort of need both of your hands. So it's sort of hard to even read when you're doing it. And it's loud, so you can't really listen to anything. So, you know, there's a couple just sort of like functionality issues that I'm trying to learn, a learning curve, right? But I do end up sort of propping the book up on under a pillow or whatever and doing some reading. But yeah, just to get through like the warming up your body takes 30 minutes alone. And then you move on to addressing specific target areas that you're trying to address. That takes another 45 minutes. So clock ticks.
Yeah, that's tough to find that that time in the day. And then on the other end is that you're playing still like three nights of hockey a week potentially, which is taking your shoulder in the other direction.
Yeah, I do wonder. You know, one thing that has had to fall by the wayside because of the shoulder is just sort of like some not as much morning stretching because I just can't. I actually can't even like, I can't do a push-up, for example. It hurts too much. So I've had to slow down on that. You go through phases that I'm just going to push through it and maybe I'm just going to work it through. Somehow hockey doesn't seem to, I'm not prevented from doing what I want to do when I'm playing hockey. There was one time where like the puck was flipped up in the air and I had to like reach up like very suddenly.
Yeah.
And that sent sort of a shooting pain into my shoulder. Another time I had to like splay out flat, like a defenseman has to do to like on a 2-on-1. And then anytime my hand has to immediately shoot above my head. Yeah. I do feel
overhead
it.
Overhead position. Yeah.
The overhead position quickly when it's done like quickly. But anyway, you know, all the things. Trying to make time for all the things.
Well, we're coming up on probably a wellness check.
Oh yeah,
episode. I think that's probably got to happen, and we'll have a few things to check in on because I haven't even mentioned this, and I won't even dive into it. So I'll just sort of save this, and this is a teaser. But I got a Submerge ice bath.
Oh, I can't wait to hear about that.
Yeah, which I haven't put it together yet, but it's out there. It's ready to go. Tau patch, the starter Tau patch kit is on the way. I think it should get here, I don't know, within a couple days. And then I also ordered the holographic blood consultation from the Bigglesons.
Oh, wow.
So
right
I did
on.
The whole like, you know, family history and things like that. So I don't, it's typically there's a little bit of a delay before they send you the kit. I think it's, you know, they've got a backlog and there's just two of them really. But so I think maybe what we'll do is we'll plan a wellness check episode after I get the Tau patches rocking a little bit.
Yeah.
And then after the holographic consultation results come back.
I love it. I picked up their father's book, Holographic Blood. I remember it was sitting on my desk and Ruthie happened to catch. I mean, there's books showing up at my house basically every day. Like you should see my bedroom is just like a cave of books. It's really funny.
Yeah.
I'm reading like seven books at a time, but just that title, Holographic Blood, and Ruth's like, the things you read. And I'm like, well, this is that, you know, we interviewed the Bigelson brothers. I was telling you about the connection to Dr. Emoto. She's like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Like it made sense to her once I gave her some context, but she's like, Holographic Blood. And anyway, the book is great. Oh, it's fantastic. It's another, like one, I would say like a terrain theory, essential reading.
Got it.
From a different decade too, right? It was written years ago. And so it's really interesting to see, you know, not as old as Beauchamp and Bernard and like some of those like sort of torchbearers, but you know, as one of the first practitioners to sort of make the switch, Dr. Bigelson. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really nice presentation of his research and a lot of that we've spoken about with some of the you know, the Pasteur versus Beauchamp that we've is sort of like foundational, but for him, where he comes into the story, I found really, really useful and interesting. So I'm really enjoying that book.
Love it. I got to get that. I'll get on that. Yep. Thank you for the reminder.
Mm-hmm. Like you need another book.
Like I need another book. But yeah, we do. Right? These are the things that we'll never not buy. You said it. Music.
It's going to be hard to move to Nicaragua with all those books, though.
It's true. It'll be its own shipping container.
Freaking A. Well, you know what? Get the hard copies, people. I mean, for F's sake, get the hard copies. That's where my head is at.
I'm with you. I thought about the collapse, post-apocalypse, and in living in that world. Like, what is the skill that I will provide to the community that I live in? And I've decided I'm just going to be the librarian.
Oh, I love that.
That I will have the books that no one else can find, and they can come here to borrow them, and you know, like for healing or gardening or herbalism or whatever. Doesn't that seem like a simple but important piece to the?
Yeah, dude, that has a great ring to it too. It's like when you look at the librarian in like a post-apocalyptic world, it takes on a whole different vibe.
Right. Right. Yeah.
I love that, Ben. Right. Well, I'll gladly donate my collection to your library because we'll be in Nicaragua together.
Yes, we will. Yes, we will. Surfing and reading. Doesn't get much better than that.
And drinking out of coconuts.
Amen. Folks, nothing you heard here should be taken as medical advice, as neither Mike nor I are medical experts. Remember that you are light. You are love. Remember to speak your truth. And you are your primary healthcare provider. Thanks for tuning in, and we will catch you on the next one.